Welcome to the Awakening Shalom Podcast. The Awakening Shalom Podcast is an opportunity for digital faith formation at Myers Park Baptist Church that accompanies the Awakening Series, a year-long journey of exploration and discernment which invites all people to come learn about the current social justice issues of the day and how they impact our faith. What we are awakening to is shalom, the Hebrew word for the peace and beauty that exists when we are living in right relationship with God, ourselves, other human beings, and all created things. Welcome back to the Awakening Shalom Podcast. I'm here with Dr. Joe Parisi, another special guest, and we are continuing to work our way through the book Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. So excited to have Joe here on the podcast with me. Some of you had the chance to sit at the feet of Joe's wise teaching during an Awakening the Body forum on a Wednesday evening as he offered a lecture to us and a conversation and even the opportunity to do some meditation. And we were very grateful for that time with Joe. And so I'm really glad to have him on the podcast. We'll spend some of our time discussing the book, but also just getting to know Joe and some of his work as we go along together. So Joe, tell us a little bit about yourself and your relationship to the practice of psychology. And
well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to be here. I earned my degree in psychology in the 1970s, and at that point moved to Charlotte. I was in California. There weren't very many jobs in California, and I knew I wanted to be on one of the two coasts, so out I came to the Mental Health Center and stayed there for a couple of years and then moved off into private practice. And while in private practice, had the pleasure and the honor first of serving as director of psychology at what was then Charter Pines Hospital, and then later as director of psychology and behavioral medicine at Presbyterian Hospital for 14 years. Hmm. And it was while I was at Presbyterian Hospital that I helped establish the Center for Mind-Body Health, which later we changed into the Center for Integrative Medicine. Hmm. That all folded when Presbyterian merged and became part of the Navant system. But we ran the programs for about 12 years. We had the first mindfulness-based stress management program as part of that. And throughout all this time, I maintained my private practice, and I'm still in practice.
Great.
At a reduced number of hours now, but I still enjoy it. And see a number of people each week and try to integrate still mindfulness into what I'm doing in therapy.
Yeah. How do you think that integrative medicine has changed your practice of psychology with people?
Well, it's an interesting question because stress affects most everything that we do in terms of illnesses. It may not be the cause of illness, but for most illnesses, it will aggravate them or make it more difficult for us to handle them. So learning how to manage stress becomes paramount. Now, I have patients I've seen who have MS, and you wouldn't know it perhaps if you just saw them or talked with them, but every so often they'll get a flare-up, and I'll get a call from them saying, I'm getting a flare-up. Can I come in? I just want to work on some stress management. We do some stress management. Usually in a week or two, they're back to normal. So whether it's MS or whether it's irritable bowel syndrome or most any illness, including cancer, there's quite a bit of research that shows that when we can relax, our immune system can operate more effectively. So putting it all together and recognizing that the mind and body never were separate.
Yes. We separated them, right?
Yeah, that's right. It was the time of Descartes when physicians of the day were trying to understand the workings of the body, just the basic physiology. But they had to steal the corpses because it was a violation to do an autopsy. And finally what happened was Descartes made a deal with the Pope. And he said, look, if you let us do autopsies and stuff, we as medicine practitioners will have jurisdiction over the physical body, while you'll maintain jurisdiction over the soul, which also included the mind. So the separation was artificially made. The interesting thing is that we're the only medical system in practice that did that. Ayurvedic medicine, the oldest medicines, Chinese medicine, never separated the two. Mm. And of course, we've had tremendous advances in what we have learned.
Yeah.
But it's time to put it back together, which, interestingly enough, it wasn't until back in the 1940s people started talking about psychosomatic illnesses. And it wasn't until the 1970s and 80s that research began clearly demonstrating the link that the mind and body are indeed interrelated.
Wow. It feels like this is so fresh right now. We're still – things are still emerging. I was just reading a whole series on trauma, and trauma studies has become huge. And there are many books now published on this. One that just comes to mind recently is called The Body Keeps the Score. And it's really about how trauma experiences in our bodies can not only they not only stay with us psychologically, it can be mental trauma or physical trauma, and they stay with us both ways, either physically, emotionally, spiritually, for our whole lives. And they can even be transmitted generationally to our children without us even really knowing. And you could think about that in terms of entire generational traumas, like the history of slavery for African Americans or Jim Crow, or, you know, just thinking about all the ways in which trauma can build up, or a family that has a history of child abuse or physical abuse over many generations, and how that trauma just continues to pass down as it goes. And I think it's very interesting to think about how to do psychology ministry with folks who are dealing with trauma from years past, and think about how that impacts the way that they walk and move in the world now, and what are the major issues in their lives that they're struggling with, and how their trauma has informed that. So people are saying trauma-informed theology or trauma-informed ministry. I just wonder what you would think about all the continued research on trauma.
Well, the research is due. It's a long time coming. Not too infrequently, I'll talk with a massage therapist, and they'll speak about touching somebody's body, and it seems tense. And when they begin working on that part of the body, memories are released.
Oh, wow.
And they were somehow stored in that part of the body. For myself, I had a recent experience where I was having surgery. But going back in time, when I was 4 or 5 years old with having a tonsillectomy, and this was back in the 1950s, prior to inducing anesthesia, and I was wide awake when went into the OR, they strapped down my arms and my legs. That was the practice of the day. And I didn't know they were going to do that, and that frightened me. And then they put the mask over my head for ether, and I just panicked. And I didn't think too much about it, but just recently, a year ago, and it's the first time I've had anesthesia with a gas mask. And they give you all those pre-op medications, but as soon as they put the mask on my face, I began coming to and trying to push it off. And I thought, isn't that interesting, this reflex, this fear that was still in my body, that despite all these medications, it triggered it for me. And
caused a reaction that you were not even aware of, right?
Yeah, which I didn't expect.
Yeah.
I didn't expect. So it does stay stored in our bodies. Again, our bodies are a whole, and it doesn't matter whether it's stored in the mind or stored in the muscle tissue. They're all one. And they can be triggered in so many ways. And, of course, it affects everything.
Yeah. It's amazing. Most of the time, we don't think about it that way at all. Most people have not been trained to think about their bodies as a whole, as all united, mind, body, soul, all working together, as impacting each other. I used to say what we do with our bodies impacts our souls, what we do with our souls impacts our bodies, and vice versa and all that. But it really is just all of it. It's all happening all at the same time. And this has extraordinarily changed the way theologians have approached the practice of ministry and theology in general, because much of Western theology, not unlike Western medicine, has divorced body from soul. and mind from body. I always find it very intriguing that Jesus's one major teaching that he keeps coming back to is the Shema prayer, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, body, and soul. There's even a bifurcation there. But what Jesus is trying to say is that it's all together. You need to love God with and neighbor with all of that. But most Christians imagine either that Christianity is a set of beliefs or a set of actions or a set of heart attitudes, when in fact it's all of those things sort of wrapped up together. And that the body, of course, as you can imagine, all these things with the body are like a Copernican revolution for theology. So mm-hmm. when something happens in the body that science comes up with, it becomes, I always say to folks, you know, people think that the issue around sexuality and gender and LGBTQ issues and awareness and inclusivity is about morality. But in fact, it is that, but it's also about science. It's a scientific Copernican revolution in gender studies and in sexuality studies about the spectrum and the coming to the understanding of that and living in a world with that that has now come back and impacted the way we think about God and our relationship to one another as human beings. The same is true of things about race or all these studies on these different topics, ethnicity, culture, nationality, that begin to then shape and form our philosophy and our theology and reinform it. And most of the times it feels like a Copernican revolution for many people who said, well, this is not how I was raised to believe, you know?
Yes, yes. They're false dichotomies.
Mm.
And once we realize that and realize that they never were separate, it was a dichotomy we created in our own minds to try to understand things.
Yeah.
But they were never real. And one of the things that has interested me over time is to look at the research that has come up demonstrating the unity of the mind and the body. There are thousands of studies at this point, but two seminal studies which I love to share with folks. The first, and this was back in the early 1990s, was by a woman by the name of Dr. Candace Peart. And she was formerly chief of one of the divisions of molecular biology at the National Institute of Health. And she was researching neuropeptides. Now, neuropeptides, if you can imagine like a string of pearls, they're in our mind. And she was trying to understand how, on a molecular level, our mind communicates from one neuron to another neuron. So she's watching these neuropeptides divide and come back together. And she was able to map out exactly how it occurs and in what part of the brain this occurs. And for the first time, somebody demonstrated how our emotions are communicated in the mind. So she identified the neuropeptides, and she also identified the receptors for these neuropeptides. And this was a wonderful finding. Now, one day, for reasons I don't totally understand, they were looking at cells, I believe it was from the inside of a stomach.
Mm.
And lo and behold, all of a sudden they found these neuropeptide receptors.
In the stomach.
And said, what are these doing in the stomach? These are supposed to be in the brain.
Yeah.
And when they looked harder, they not only found the receptors, they found that the stomach could create those same neuropeptides. And to make a long story short, that got them intrigued, and like so many results in science, they're found by accident. They began looking at the heart, the lungs, the intestines. It didn't matter where they looked. Here are these neuropeptide receptors. And when they looked at the immune system, on every cell of the immune system were these neuropeptide receptors.
Wow.
So we, found... With that finding, we have to stand back and rethink perhaps and change our paradigm about the body itself. And it was Deepak Chopra who said that we have a thinking body.
Mm.
The old saying that I knew in my stomach or I knew in my heart it was wrong.
Yeah.
We actually now have the biological evidence that that's true. And that the only difference in the brain is that this is where thought is linguistically structured.
Mm.
But otherwise, our whole bodies knows what's happening and indeed acts as a whole. If we look at another research example that was found by accident, was at the University of Ohio when they were working with rabbits, and what they were trying to do was investigate the effect of drugs on cardiovascular disease and how quickly arteries clog and stuff. So they had all these rabbits, and they were feeding them a high-fat diet or whatever they were doing, and they were genetically bred to develop heart disease very quickly. And they quickly discovered that some of the rabbits weren't getting heart disease the way they were supposed to. And they couldn't understand why this was happening. So they began looking at everything they could think of, which rabbits were positioned closer to the lights, which one were closer to the windows, and so on and so forth, to try to understand it. And nothing seemed to pan out until they looked at the individual, it was a graduate student, who was being paid to feed the animals. And what was not written in her job description was, because she was an animal lover, after she would feed them, and the animals are on cages on a wall, and she was rather short, but for the animals in the bottom cages, she would go and pet, and she would talk sweetly to them. And in those particular rabbits, they developed heart disease 60% less than the rabbits on the top of the cages that didn't have contact.
That she couldn't reach, right?
That she couldn't reach, exactly. That somehow the experience of emotional contact as opposed to isolation was producing physiological changes in the body's ability to metabolize cholesterol and henceforth not form heart disease.
It's incredible, really.
Yeah, and there's research study after research study after that. So Larry Dorsey coined the term. He said there are actually three errors in medicine. He said error one began with Descartes when we separated the mind and the body. Mm. Error two began in the 1970s and 80s when we began putting them back together. And error three, he said, will occur with the introduction of a spiritual dimension which recognizes a higher power that we are all a part of. And when we bring in that part into medicine and reclaim the wholeness of our existence, then that becomes error three in medicine.
Wow. Well, it'd be nice to see Era 3 come pretty soon here.
Yes.
Some people are probably living Era 3 lives, though, now, and they're doing so by engaging something I know that is really a passion of yours, which is the practice of meditation. And I wonder if you could talk about how you got initially involved and interested or introduced to meditation. I know you've been a long practitioner of it. How many years have you been practicing meditation in?
Well, on a daily basis for about 29 years every day.
Wow. Yeah.
But my history of meditation goes back further. I was at the University of Connecticut as an undergraduate. And at that point, my experience as a child, I was raised Catholic and decided as an adolescent that this was not a good fit. And I was much more interested in the experience of God than I was in an intellectual understanding, but didn't quite know where to look. Had some sense that maybe Eastern religions were talking more my language at that point.
Right.
And one day there was a sign up at the student union which said there was going to be a yoga class that night. Now, this is 1969.
It's revolutionary in 69.
Yeah. And I thought, well, let me go. What have I got to lose? And so I went to the class, and it was taught by a monk from Swami Satchidananda's ashram, which was close by. And at the end of the class, I was in such a state of relaxation, and I thought, I've never felt this way, at least not without drugs.
That's right.
I didn't know it was possible.
Yeah.
And it opened up a whole dimension for me, which for me had a strong spiritual component, and I began to get a sense of, this is what I've been missing. And so for the next year and a half or 2 years, I went to yoga classes every week and began studying the Bhagavad Gita and all that, and became very much involved with that. I later lost some of the practice, or began not practicing regularly when I got so overwhelmed with graduate school and all the time it was taking and then graduating, although I never gave it up. And then back in the later 80s when I found, you know, I'm getting stressed out from practicing so much and I'm not taking the kind of care I need to of myself, I thought, I need to go back to this. And the interesting thing was at that point, right as about as I discovered that, I found that Swami Sachidananda had an ashram up in Virginia.
How about that?
So up I went, reestablished practice of meditation. And from that, I discovered Thich Nhat Hanh, a Zen Buddhist, a Vietnamese Zen Buddhist monk. And when I read what he was doing and how he described things, I thought, he's speaking my language.
Yeah.
And was a wonderful intersection of psychology and meditation and, for me, spiritual, a strong spiritual dimension.
Yeah.
So I went on a couple retreats with him. This was in the early 90s. And in 1993, we established the Charlotte Community of Mindfulness here at this church.
Wow.
It was, originally we were just a Sunday school. We started at 8:30 so people could go off to their second Sunday school.
Yeah. Sunday school before Sunday school, pre-Sunday school.
Exactly. Yeah. Trying to get psychologically ready for the second Sunday school.
Some Sunday school classes are still like that. You should meditate before you go.
Yes. And over time, it's become its own little group.
Yeah.
Although quite a few members of the class are also members of the church.
Yeah.
And we still meet every Sunday at 8:30. And I'm happy to say that since then, there are a number of mindfulness offerings throughout the community where people can go to learn and mindfulness groups, so they're not limited to any one source. In that process, I might also mention Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a wonderful book called Living Buddha, Living Christ.
I remember when I read that book. I actually read that book as a senior in high school.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
Yeah, where he blended the two together. And in fact, I remember on my first retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh up in New York, and I'm not remembering his name now, but he was one of the priests from the Catholic Church here in Charlotte. I think he and I were the only people in Charlotte up there at the time. And so it was this priest and myself in terms of anyone that I knew. So it quickly became apparent to me that although the practice of meditation itself, at least mindfulness meditation, can be secular, and often people would be fearful of, well, do I have to give up my religious beliefs to do this? And when we started the program at Presbyterian, the mind-body stress reduction program, which was based on mindfulness, there was a lot of fear in the community back then. We were doing mindfulness. We were doing yoga. We got some letters from some ministers in the community saying, why is a Presbyterian hospital teaching Eastern religions? I actually had to go before the
Would you rather them teach Presbyterianism? I mean, goodness.
Well, and I went before the entire medical board before we started the program to get their blessing. And they gave us their blessing.
Okay.
But there was that kind of fear. And we actually met with one of the ministers, Joe Chambers, who had quite a reputation of being a white ring spokesperson for the community. But after we met with them, I'm happy to say we were able to explain to him what we were doing.
Good.
And how it could fit into anybody's spiritual path if they wanted it to be that.
Good.
That essentially we're working on developing what I call the two wings of mindfulness, the first one being an awareness of the present moment so that we're not caught so much in the present or the past, in the future or the past.
Right.
And secondly, the second wing, and oftentimes people don't learn about this part quite as much, and it's the development of compassion and being able to recognize that it becomes important to bring loving kindness to all of ourselves, because oftentimes when we sit to meditate and we turn our attention to our minds, we don't like what we see. It was Anne Lamott who once said, My mind is a very scary place, and I never like to go there alone.
So, such a great quote. She has a way of putting things, doesn't she?
Yes, she does. I thought, yes, that's very true.
Yeah.
So we may be meditating. We may end up becoming aware of sadness or despair or feelings that we don't necessarily like. And so bringing kindness and acceptance to those parts of ourselves becomes an integral part of the practice.
I think that is such an important place to stop for a second and kind of dwell there, because I read a book by a Jesuit teacher and also had a week with him. His name is Wilkie Au, and he's also a Jungian psychotherapist, but also a Jesuit priest, and he brings those two together in all of his writings. But he wrote a book called about healing shame. That's basically what the book's about. And he uses a meditative practice of compassionate embrace. Loving kindness is what it's called, I think, in Buddhist tradition. But he calls it compassionate embrace. It's sort of a Christian spin on it. And it's basically this practice of sitting and imagining yourself being embraced in the love of God. And, or grace, or just being, and then he, you know, walking through different parts of yourself that you imagine are being embraced by the love of God, and repeating to yourself that I'm a child made in the image of God, I'm a beloved child of God, and or you know, and sitting in that for a while, and it's been a couple, I don't know, a year or so since I experienced that with him that week. It is amazing how powerful that practice can be for those who are struggling. For anyone, really, but particularly for those who are struggling with issues of shame, and shame related to some traumatic incidents, shame related to their own behavior or actions, shame related to what their body looks like and what they feel like. And I found it to be quite transformative. And I wonder if you could talk about how the practice of self-compassion then develops in your understanding into compassion toward others in the world. How are they related in the way you see it and have seen it practiced?
That's a good question. Beginning first with ourselves, there are a number of meditations that are focused on developing that compassion. And for instance, one of the meditations I'll often teach people is as they're sitting and they begin to experience the shame or the despair or the fear, whatever it is they're struggling with in their bodies and what Jung would call our shadows, to get a sense of where they're feeling it in their body, and then to take their hand and place it on that part of their body. Now, maybe it's their throat because their throat is feeling tight, or it could be their shoulders. And if it feels like it's all over your body and they don't know where it is, just to put their hand on their heart and to work with the phrases breathing in, I'm aware of this despair or this fear, whatever it is, this shame. Breathing out, I bring all my tenderness to this shame. And of course you can change the verb there, so I bring all my kindness, or I bring all my love, all my caring to this shame.
Wow.
And just working with that phrase over and over again, breathing in, I'm aware of my shame. Breathing out, I bring all my caring to this shame. And to envision ourselves holding this and feeling the pressure of our hands on our bodies, just like we would touch a friend. Many people are able to bring compassion and kindness to their friends.
Yeah.
And it's harder to bring it to themselves.
Right.
So when we work with bringing it to ourselves, it becomes a good place to start. And then there are meditations that we can work with that help us bring that same loving kindness to those around us.
Right.
And so if we just begin with, may I have peace? May I be safe in this world.
Yeah.
And then may my family have peace.
Yeah.
May they be safe in this world. May my teachers have peace. May they be safe in the world.
Yeah.
And then comes the hardest one. May my enemies have peace. May they be safe in the world. And finally, may all sentient beings have peace. May they be safe in the world. So I think that when we can bring understanding and kindness to ourselves, it naturally begins to flow towards others, towards understanding. We begin to empathize perhaps a little bit easier with them, and holding them in that same sense of kindness.
Yeah. I think that that's, you know, Jesus always has that phrase, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. So if you really don't love yourself, or if you hate yourself, or you're ashamed of yourself, you won't be able to fully love the neighbor, or you'll only love the, I almost think it's, he's sort of saying, you will love the neighbor as yourself. If you don't love yourself, will not love the neighbor, right?
It's almost a warning.
Yeah, perhaps, it really is. Yeah.
Perhaps it is a warning. And it is interesting because in therapy, when I'm working with folks, I want people to be able to love themselves. And sometimes we'll work with the kinds of meditations I'm talking about and other therapeutic strategies. But sometimes it's easier for people to begin loving others first. And when they find that, okay, here's a child and I experience love towards them, I haven't shut down those feelings, then they can work from there and begin to expand it.
Right.
And I'll say oftentimes something like, well, can you imagine yourself as a 5-year-old little boy or little girl?
Yeah.
And look in their eyes and bring kindness to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Remember what it was like to be that 5-year-old and go back there. Sometimes that's where our most painful traumas and shame begin, in childhood, with a relationship with a parent or with a relationship with friends or an embarrassment that took place that we carry with us in our bodies somewhere, that we need to go back to that place and imagine ourselves in that moment of shame. And I've talked on this podcast with others as we've done bodies. We talked about humiliating stories of our bodies, times when we were totally embarrassed in school and high school. And we need to go back to those places and remember where we were and imagine ourselves being embraced by God's love and compassion or just our own self-compassion and loving kindness. That can be very healing, I think, for people.
Yes, to realize that we all have that child inside of us. That's a false dichotomy.
Mm-hmm.
Those feelings are here in the present.
Right, right. The child doesn't go away.
No,
it just becomes
very
part
much
of us.
Here. Yeah. And actually, we can use that to our advantage.
Okay.
Because we can begin then to talk to the child in us. So the adult in us can begin to say, I know you're in there.
Yeah.
And you're safe now because I'm going to take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
And what you learned when you were 5 years old wasn't true.
Mm.
The truth is you have a beautiful body. Or the truth is it's okay to feel angry, or it's okay to feel sad. It's okay to cry.
Yeah.
And I can take care of you now. And I can learn what I need to take care of you.
Right, right.
And then, of course, the child will often respond back and us, I don't believe you.
Yeah, I don't trust you. I don't trust you. I'm going to get punished or something. Yeah.
But at least at that point, you've started a dialogue within yourself.
Mm.
There are some therapy systems that are based on all our subpersonalities and learning to create a communication within
right.
ourselves, to the parts of ourselves that have been cut off, to the parts of ourselves that, again, Carl Jung would hold as the shadow inside us. I've always enjoyed a quote that Jon Kabat-Zinn made. He said, "We need to hold the spaces of darkness and horror in us with integrity and kindness and stay at it out of some insane commitment to be whole."
You should read that again. That's amazing. I want to hear that.
We need to hold the spaces of darkness and horror in us with integrity and kindness and stay at it out of some insane commitment to be whole.
That is, that's about as Jungian as it gets right there, doesn't it?
Yes.
I remember him saying, I can't remember if it's Jung who said this or Wilkie Au, one of the Jungian priests who I was telling you about just a minute ago, that if you will, instead of running away from your shadow, maybe it's Jung who says this, if you run away from your shadow or ignore it, it continues to grow in size. But when you confront your shadow and embrace your shadow, you'll find that it will give you gifts.
Well, that's exactly right. The healing occurs when we can touch with love and mercy and compassion those parts of ourselves that we are running away from, the parts of us that we usually are so angry and upset about that we're trying to push away. But it's only love that creates transformation. And so when we can bring kindness to those parts of ourselves, that's when we get better.
Mm. And you imagine, and I'm sure you've seen in your own practice, people who have taken on the practice of meditation and had major health improvements, right? Not just in general, their own, I mean, as if this was not a miracle enough, but to be more attentive and mindful in their own daily life, but just generally to become more healthy through the practice of meditation, bodily, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, when we were running the mind-body stress reduction program at Presbyterian, I connected with a psychologist out at the UNC Charlotte because we were gathering some research data, and one of the pieces of data we were gathering was called the SCL90, which measured on 9 different dimensions how people were functioning. And one of those dimensions were psychosomatic illnesses. And I said, hey, we have all this data here, but I don't have the capacity to analyze it, and so on and so forth. And so he came in and he analyzed it. And we found a significant reduction on 7 of the 9 variables.
Wow.
And again, one of those variables was how many headaches people were having, all these psychosomatic symptoms, and there was a significant reduction.
Yeah, that's amazing. I wish, you know, more people would engage in the practice of meditation, but I think one of the things that you've already hit on is that they're two areas. First is people have a difficult time integrating it into either a very secular worldview that is strictly sort of materialist related to medicine and science, or integrating it into a very religious worldview that has been dominated by a particular kind of theology that says, well, if you just read the Bible and do what the Bible says you should do, then you're going to be fine and you don't need these practices of meditation. Of course, that is to miss the deep and long and wide mystical and spiritual and meditative tradition within Christianity that has been going on from the very beginning, that has, you know, oftentimes turned into religious orders or particular kinds of narrow ways for certain people, but really was supposed to be for everyone to imagine how they would practice that. So, you know, how do we help people to engage in meditation if they're either coming from a very religious worldview or if they're coming from a very materialist worldview, or as many people in our own congregation have that duality within them? Let's keep my religion over here and my belief in science over here, and they don't really need to talk a lot. I do this on Sundays and the rest of the week I'm over here, and I don't need them interacting with each other. Whereas when you start meditating, everything kind of starts to blur together. Body, mind, soul, religion, life in the world, your work, home, all of it starts to get integrated through the practice. And I wonder, how do you help people overcome their resistance to it from either of those perspectives?
Well, it's all, of course, a false dichotomy that there are separate parts of us to begin with.
Right, right.
But there are different types of meditation, and in our journeys through life, different types might be more helpful than others. For people who are very embedded in the Christian tradition and perhaps frightened of anything that might have an Eastern tinge to it, I often will turn them towards Father Thomas Keating's work of centering prayer.
Yeah.
He I forget if he was Jesuit, but I know he was Catholic.
Yeah.
And he was up in Massachusetts, and he became very enamored through transcendental meditation and thought, you know, this belongs in Christianity too. And he developed centering prayer, which is a Christian version of it. And I've had many people in my practice go off, and you can learn centering prayer here in Charlotte. It doesn't cost anything.
Yeah.
If you simply Google it and the words Charlotte, it'll come up with a number of churches and where they have classes and stuff.
Yeah.
And for them, that's a nice way to begin.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to find a way to begin that feels right for us. And for other people, sitting meditation is helpful. Again, there are different types of sitting meditation. There's the practice of mindfulness. There's also the practice of using mantras or centering words, which, of course, goes back to what Thomas Keaton did with centering prayer. There's walking meditation. And to understand what, again, mindfulness is all about, because right now I call it McMindfulness.
Yeah.
It's caught the attention of the American public.
Yeah.
And one has to be a little bit careful with that.
Yeah, somebody's going to trademark, yeah.
But to understand that there's also two types of meditation. Now, sometimes when people come and they say, well, I tried meditation, but it didn't work for me because I couldn't stop thinking. And what that tells me is that the meditation instructions left parts out.
Yeah.
The purpose of the mind is to think, and we're not necessarily trying to stop thinking at all. We can't do that. It's like saying to someone, don't think of pink elephants as you listen to this podcast.
You're thinking of pink elephants,
right?
Right.
They'll be dancing across a visual screen just like a Walt Disney movie. You can't do it.
Yeah.
But what's important is to become aware of our thoughts. And when we're in meditation, at least with mindfulness meditation, once we're lost in our thoughts, once they've kidnapped us and they're usually taking us off on some storyline of some sort or another, to realize, I'm lost in my thoughts again. So let me come back to my breathing or whatever I'm using as a centering point. And if we get lost in our thoughts 100 times, that's fine. We just come back to our breathing 100 times.
Right.
And that becomes the practice. So there's formal meditation like that, but the real goal of mindfulness is to live our entire lives in mindfulness.
Yes. Yeah.
So there's the informal practice. So as people are perhaps listening to this now, if they can have 10% of their awareness, let's say, on their breathing, and the other 90% on what they're listening to, we would call that listening meditation.
Yeah, yeah. So they can go through their life, and anything that they're doing, they can approach it from a meditative perspective.
Exactly. Whether we're driving our car, we can do that mindfully.
It's like Jesus saying, pray without ceasing.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I think from a health perspective that this has tremendous applications, whether we're talking about attention deficit disorder, which people often say, I know I have it, but what can I do without drugs? Well, our breathing anchors us, and it prevents the mind from wandering quite the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
So it helps us settle, helps us remember to calm down, and helps us stay in the present moment. People often say, just stay in the present, but they don't tell you how.
Right, that's right. Well, I think one of the things, for my own practice, and I have certainly not been practicing as long or as much as you have, but I, in my own practice of meditation, I have found that if I don't engage in compassionate loving kindness as I bring my attention back to my breathing, I lose myself, much more often into my thoughts. So if I try to aggressively force myself back into it, or if I start to say, I can't believe you lost yourself in your thoughts again. Look at you. You're bad at meditation. I've immediately started the judgment and shame spiral, and I'm already lost. Yeah.
That's such an important point. Because it right at that juncture, when we realize we're lost in thoughts, if sometimes we can remember, my mind must have had a reason for thinking this.
Yeah.
And with as much kindness as we can, kind of like training a puppy.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just bring ourselves back and just come back to our breath over and over again with as much kindness and caring as we're capable of.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I'm meditating, when I realize I'm lost in thoughts, well, two things that I do. Sometimes I'll just say, yes, this too.
Yeah, this too.
And sometimes I'll have an image of a campfire. And maybe at first I'm lost in putting together the grocery list for the night. And I'll say, okay, come and have a seat
yeah.
by the campfire. And then I realize I'm anxious about something that I'm doing. I say, okay, you can have a seat by the campfire too.
Yeah.
And every time I get lost, I just invite that part in to be a part of me.
Right.
Because it is a part of me. And have a seat by the campfire.
Mm. Now, do you think if somebody, let's say somebody is practicing walking meditation pretty regularly, and that's just what they do that once or twice a day or once or twice a week, is there a different benefit in your mind to a walking meditation versus sitting meditation?
For me, there is.
Okay.
There are times when I'm agitated, and especially times if something has upset me where it's hard for me to sit.
Yeah.
There's too much energy in my body.
Yeah.
And walking can be exactly the right thing I need to do at those points in time.
Yeah, yeah.
So depending on my state of mind and how I'm feeling, the walking meditation for me is a much better fit. And for folks who practice walking meditation, of course, there's formal walking meditation, and we have a labyrinth here at the church that people can use. You can do it actually at any time in your house, just walk in a circle with nowhere to go.
That's basically a labyrinth.
That's right. You're practicing walking meditation. But every time we have to walk during the day, if we get out of our car to walk into the grocery store, if we can just maybe take a little bit of an edge off and coordinate our walking with our breathing, that's how we can anchor it. So when we breathe in, maybe we take two steps or three steps, and then when we breathe out, we take two steps or three breaths. Awareness that we're walking on the earth. It was a Zen master many years ago who said that the true miracle in life is neither walking on water nor walking on air. It's walking on the earth and recognizing that that's what we're doing. Hmm. That's a miracle to be able to walk.
Yeah, that's amazing. Would you give people would you suggest people maybe use a mantra from time to time as they walk, or a word, almost as if they're doing centering prayer that they're breathing in, or maybe one of the breathing exercises related to shame and loving kindness that they could do as they walk?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You can use whatever mantra fits for you. So as you breathing in and taking several steps, it could be the word peace, and as you breathe out, the word shalom or the word calm, or it could just be breathing in, I'm aware of this shame, and breathing out, I bring all my kindness, or I just smile to this shame.
Mm,
sometimes that's the mantra we want to use.
Yes, or sort of laugh at it, right, as if it's ridiculous, you know, and you're able to overcome its power then. You take its power away from its hold over your life by doing that. Yeah, it's a beautiful way of approaching it. Well, I just want to come back to the book really quickly as we come to the end of our time together and ask, as you have remembered your reading of Being Mortal, and I think how do you think the practice of meditation, which I don't think he talks about at all in the book very often, would help human beings with the things that he recommends related to dying and medicine, which is to accept our limitations and to develop a courageous ability to approach death without fear and to have the hard conversations we need to have so that we're not prolonging our life unnecessarily through forms of aggressive medicine that are putting us in a position where we don't have quality of life at the end.
In Buddhist practice, they have what's called the five remembrances.
Mm.
And the first remembrance is growing old. I know I am of the nature to grow old. There's nothing I can do to prevent growing old.
Yeah.
And the second is becoming sick and ill. I know I'm of the nature to become sick and ill, and there's nothing I can do to prevent it. And then they go on to the fact that we're going to die.
Yeah.
And with meditation, I think it becomes important to bring up those remembrances every day.
Yeah.
And the feelings associated with them, and just to breathe with them and embrace them. It's normal and natural in some ways to fear death. It's just built into our DNA.
Sure.
And if we can begin to embrace the fears and embrace the anxiety and accept that, yes, we're all impermanent.
Mm.
This is a part of our path. I remember reading Tuesdays with Morrie. And one of the things that Morey said was that he wished for every human being there'd be a little bird that would land on our shoulder and whisper in our ear, someday you're going to die.
Yeah.
So it would break this delusion we all get in that we're here forever.
Right.
So we can work with that with our meditation or with our prayers to recognize that this is part of being a human.
Mm.
That's part of what makes life so special.
Yeah.
And then when the time comes, we not torture ourselves.
Right.
And literally torture ourselves with some of the medical interventions that we can sometimes use far beyond when they're really helpful.
Yeah, I've often thought that little bird for those who are followers of Jesus should be pretty easy, since we are called daily by Jesus to die, to take up our crosses and to die to ourselves and to all the idols of the world that are trying to take to war over our hearts and our souls and our minds. And it should be, and to understand that in every death, in every time we're able to accept death, there is the possibility of resurrection, of small resurrections, maybe not like a grand eternal kind of resurrection, but daily dying and raising is part of what it means to grow as we go. It's part of the process of maturity. And you would imagine that Christians would be aware, having just a general lifelong awareness of their own death, where each day they wake up knowing that this could be the last day that they have on earth and how do they want to spend it. But I find that that's not the case with many people of faith. They don't ever really think about their death until they get sick or ill or until somebody they love dies. When in reality, as you've mentioned, if you think about these five remembrances, although I don't know, I'm trying to remember if there's a Christian practice similar to that in Christian meditation, but where you just say, yeah, I'm limited. I mean, Ash Wednesday, the purpose of yes. the whole Ash Wednesday and the whole season of Lent is to say, I am mortal, I will die, mm-hmm. and thank God for, you know, that God holds me in the midst of this life and the next
exactly.
in love, you know, and thank God for grace. But we don't say that daily. It's a once a year sort of thing. Some do probably, but it's not a regular practice for many. It would be very helpful, I think, because we don't prepare ourselves for the existential crisis that we will all face without having a daily reminder of our own limitations and our own frailty and mortality. And that also creates, if you're able to do it daily, it creates a really deep level of humility, I think, and awareness toward the neighbor, not just yourself, but others that, you know, if you know you're going to die, all the grandiosities that we can sometimes, all the projections of our own ego we can overcome a lot of those if we have a sense of our own limitations.
Oh, I couldn't agree any more with what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yes.
Yeah. Well, Joe, thank you for your time with me today. It's really been a pleasure. And I wonder if there's anything you could leave our listeners with who are hoping to find their way into God's shalom and peace. What one practice would you leave them with, one challenge for their lives?
Oh, that's a good question. And I think it comes back to bringing loving kindness to ourselves.
Yeah.
And when that feels difficult, if they can perhaps imagine Jesus or maybe it's a grandmother or a grandfather or it was an uncle who was for them someone who exhibited unconditional love and yeah. kindness, and to imagine ourselves held by that kindness, that perhaps down deep, all that we really are is loving awareness. And so to remind ourselves of that and imagine ourselves being held by that loving kindness, generating it in our own heart, that it's already there.
Yeah.
And bring that to ourselves every day. Mm. That would be the practice I would hope to leave people with.
That's a wonderful practice. And we hope that you will engage in the practice of loving kindness and compassionate embrace. And as you do, we pray that you will find your own healing and closer relationship with the source of your life. Joe, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. You're welcome.
We'll talk to you all next time. Bye-bye.